Welcome to You Are Not Broken, the only podcast that combines science, medicine, and psychology to re-educate your brain and help you live your best love life. And I'm your host, board-certified female urologist, Dr. Casperson.
Hey friends, today I'm so excited to have Dr. Jill Kraft in today because she is a lichen sclerosis expert. She works and practices on the East Coast, and January 17th is National Lichen Sclerosis Day. So we are doing this podcast episode in celebration and awareness of this condition that's kind of silent, right? So Dr. Kraft, can you tell us like how you got to be a lichen sclerosis researcher and, you know, medicine provider?
Yes, of course. So lichen sclerosis is a condition that's difficult because it's a condition that's really between two medical specialties. Essentially, you have gynecologists who look at the vulvar area, which is where lichen sclerosis predominantly affects. Gynecologists look at this area all day, every day, but there's not great training in skin conditions, even in this area. And so that's an issue. And then the other thing is the dermatologists, which are commonly doctors that are known to treat skin and nails and hair, they know a lot about lichen sclerosis on different parts of the body, but they don't typically look at the genital area. Even when they do a full body skin check, they may take a quick peek, but they're not really having someone set up in the position that a gynecologist would to really thoroughly examine this area, or doing something like a vulvoscopy, which would more thoroughly examine this area. And so, as you can imagine, this condition is often missed or misdiagnosed, or there's a delay in diagnosis because it really falls between the expertise of two specialties. You really need to have a dermatologist that has expertise in vulvar skin conditions, or you need to have a gynecologist that has expertise in vulvar skin conditions. And that's where I can't come in. So basically, I had extra training with sexual pain conditions. And a part of that are skin conditions that can cause pain in this area, because lichen sclerosis can cause scarring, which can lead to pain with insertion and covering of the clitoris. And that can lead to some sexual side effects. And so through that, I worked with many patients that had skin conditions of this area, including lichen sclerosis. And I started to read everything that I possibly could about it. I started to do research in this area. And then when I left academic medicine and I joined a private practice, I joined the Center for Vulvovaginal Disorders with Dr. Andrew Goldstein. And this center has the most patients with lichen sclerosis out of anywhere in the country, probably anywhere in the world. I think that at last check, in all of the years, there's been upwards of 2,000 patients with lichen sclerosis that he's treated, we've treated together. And so with that comes a lot of expertise, right? Because you've seen literally everything. You're able to troubleshoot things that someone who sees lichen sclerosis maybe once a month or a couple times a year may not encounter. And so, so basically working through this center, which I'm a part of, I've had special training and then developed, additional experience and expertise through that. And then, in addition, I am doing my own research on lichen sclerosis. And my area of research is really in women of reproductive age or people of reproductive age with vulvar lichen sclerosis, because I think that this is a group that is really neglected in the textbooks and in the research. Specialists who see lichen sclerosis know that there's a big subset of women in their 20s, 30s, 40s who have lichen sclerosis, but it's rarely documented, talked about, or researched. And I think that a lot of these patients have sexual side effects. And so I really want to bring that to light and decrease the delay in diagnosis that we see with these patients.
Beautiful. Because I think it's a myth that It doesn't happen in women with, that are non-low hormone status, right? So like what I was taught, it was like there's two, bimodal distributions. It's postmenopause, it's pre-puberty, and then you're kind of, you don't think about the people in the middle. But the work I've seen you do is like, no, that's kind of just a myth. We think that, decreasing the hormones might bring it out a little bit more. Or can you talk a little bit about that and like risk factors?
Absolutely. So yes, I mean, if you looked at the textbooks, you would see that this is a condition of girls before puberty and postmenopausal people. And so, that area in the middle is kind of like a void. And what we don't have a lot of research on this because not a lot of research has been done yet. But what we think is that even though hormones or low estrogen or low testosterone does not cause lichen sclerosis, it's very possible that natural states in the lifetime of low estrogen or low estrogen and testosterone caused by different factors, including medications, may actually bring out the symptoms. So the understanding here is that lichen sclerosis is likely an autoimmune condition. What does that mean? It means that there is likely a protein or a series of proteins in the bottom layer of the skin that, for whatever reason, the body determines is not self. And the response to that is for the local immune system. So within that skin, where that protein is expressed, the immune system brings in inflammation, so inflammatory factors to attack the protein that it determines is not self. Now, we can't say 100% that this is an autoimmune condition because we haven't discovered that protein or series of proteins yet. We're working on it. We're actually getting closer and closer. We've identified the genes that are upregulated and downregulated in lichen sclerosis. But allowing us, and this is all very new research. We just published that, I believe, last month. And so this is important because if we can determine what is being targeted in lichen sclerosis by the immune system, we can develop more targeted therapies. Because right now, the gold standard therapy that we have is a topical steroid, which decreases the inflammation. But if we can determine what's causing the inflammation in the first place, then we can get one step closer to a targeted therapy that would not be a topical steroid.
Beautiful. Yeah, because my question would be like, how can we not get lichen sclerosis? How can we prevent lichen sclerosis? Any insight yet, or like that's years down the road?
It's something that I think people have a genetic predisposition to. Why do people develop Hashimoto's thyroiditis? Why do people develop Graves' disease? Why do people develop, all of these different autoimmune conditions, right? I think because this involves the genital area, there's a lot of heaviness attached to it. Like, what did I do to cause this? Why is this happening? Whereas, people may question that with thyroid disease, but it just doesn't seem to have quite the heaviness with it, that a condition that affects the genitals, like lichen sclerosis, has. I think that there's probably a genetic component. We've seen that in the research. There, it's autoimmune, so people are probably predisposed, and then there's a series of factors that bring out the condition. And those factors are likely related to environmental exposure, diet, stress with cortisol levels, and then other factors that we may not even have identified or connected yet. And it creates the perfect storm that brings this out. We've noticed that during low estrogen and possibly low testosterone states, that people tend to get diagnosed with this. We talked about that a little bit with before puberty, after menopause. But we've also observed that there may be a relation with different medications, like certain birth control pills that decrease the amount of testosterone or lower estrogen to really, really low levels. In addition, there's other life stages, like after someone has had a baby. So, in the postpartum stage or breastfeeding, where we know estrogen and testosterone levels are super low, people tend to either be more symptomatic or they get diagnosed in these times or they've noticed that their symptoms start during these times. And again, again, we don't have a lot of research on this. It's something to explore. It's something to look into further. But it's important for people to know about this because it explains a little bit why they developed the symptoms when they developed them, or why the symptoms seem to wax and wane or come and go, because it can be related on the local immune function and how much inflammation is being produced at a given time, which can be affected by many different factors.
So if you have lichen sclerosis and it doesn't bother you, so say you were getting a pap smear or say, you know, whatever, you delivered a baby and somebody said, hey, I think you have lichen sclerosis and does this bother you? And people are like, no, it doesn't really bother me. What would you do in that situation? Should we always treat it because it's going to get worse, or should we just treat symptoms only? Do you see that scenario?
I do. Yes. And so this is really valid because a certain percentage of people are actually picked up or diagnosed inadvertently, like they don't have symptoms and we see signs of it and we say, oh, this looks like lichen sclerosis. And then we may recommend a biopsy and it comes back as lichen sclerosis. The guidelines differ on how to handle a situation like this. Personally, I would recommend treatment because of a couple different factors. Number one, you want to avoid any future inflammation or scarring that can result. You don't want someone to become symptomatic. If I started someone on a treatment regimen, it would be a maintenance regimen, which is very, very low, or even less than that. The other thing is that we know that lichen sclerosis does have a risk of progressing to a precancer or a cancer. Now, that's extraordinarily unlikely to happen if someone's not having any visual signs or symptoms of it, because it needs to really be what we call active to progress in that way. It's the inflammation that causes cells to make mistakes that lead to a precancer, which is vulvar intraepithelial neoplasia, or VIN, a differentiated VIN, or even a vulvar cancer. And so it would be extraordinarily unlikely to have someone completely asymptomatic that progress to something like that. But we like to prevent anything that we can. And so if I diagnose someone, even if they're, maybe they had it as a kid and they have residual scarring, but they're not currently active, or maybe we diagnose it just based visually and they have no symptoms, I would recommend treating at a maintenance regimen for that reason. But not all providers are going to do it that way or agree with that.
Fair enough. I was taught that, you know, if you're going to start somebody on a steroid for lichen sclerosis, make sure they're also on an estrogen product because it just really helps the health of the skin. Would you agree with that? Would you agree with that in the premenopausal age group? And then what's the role of topical testosterone if we think it might be testosterone mediated?
That's a great question. So I think that anybody who's postmenopausal or even perimenopausal, I would really consider doing a topical estrogen, usually a testosterone as well, in these patients. When you're talking about much younger patients that are, for example, cycling on their own, we know they have adequate estrogen, then it becomes a little more of a counseling session with those patients. I wouldn't go as far to say that, you know, anyone that's being treated for lichen sclerosis should be on a local hormone. I don't think that that's necessary. I think that you treat what diagnosis you have. So if a patient has hormonally mediated vestibulodynia, meaning pain at the vaginal opening due to low estrogen and namely testosterone, or if they have genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which is the new term for vulvovaginal atrophy, then you treat that, right? Hormones aren't a treatment per se of lichen sclerosis, but I think that they can be a great adjunct for people who meet the criteria of a decreased hormone diagnosis.
Perfect. So just jumping on hormone-mediated vestibulodynia real quick. So say you have a woman and she's, you know, she cycles on her own, so she's premenopausal, and you're going to do a topical testosterone estrogen for that hormone-mediated vestibulodynia. What's the role of systemic hormones? Would you check her testosterone and see if it's low and supplement it to think maybe the body is, this is like the end result of that? Or do we stay away from systemic in all cases?
Great question. So I think what we're what we need to realize is that there's another component here that we need to consider, and that is the strength of testosterone receptors at the level of the greater vestibular glands. Okay. So looking at your systemic testosterone or your lab values is not the whole story. You need to not only look at how much testosterone is present. You also need to look at how much free testosterone is present. So what's the unbound testosterone? So what is your sex hormone binding globulin? And then the other component is, okay, how well is that free testosterone binding to the receptors at the glands, where it's working and on the tissue, where these hormone receptors are prevalent. And so that's the missing component. And that explains why some people develop this kind of pain related to hormones and other people don't. We know that there's many people out there that take birth control pills, but only a small subset of them develop sexual pain symptoms from them. How is that explained? Well, we did a research study to look at that, to determine that. And we found that people on birth control pills that develop sexual pain, that develop provoked vestibulodynia, had weaker testosterone receptors. They had more CAG repeats in the gene that codes for their testosterone receptors found in the blood than people that were taking birth control pills that had absolutely no problems at all. We see in menopause, we have people who look severely deficient in estrogen, yet they have no symptoms at all, right? And then we have people that have awful, awful symptoms of GSM. And so I think we need to consider, consider their testosterone receptors and how well they're working. Now, if we flood the local area with testosterone and estrogen, then it can overcome the challenges of what we're born with how well our testosterone receptors work. And that's the idea with using a local estradiol testosterone gel at the vestibule where those gland ostia or gland openings are located. So really it's a clinical diagnosis. There's a lot of factors that go into it. And that's why seeing, a specialist or someone with experience with this can help you make really good decisions here. It's not a one size fits all approach.
What are the classic sexual symptoms that women talk about with lichen sclerosis?
Yes. So most of it is related to the scarring that occurs with lichen sclerosis. So with lichen sclerosis, lichen sclerosis in Latin literally translates to thickening and scarring, lichen sclerosis. And so the thickening describes the effects of the inflammation in the actual skin or tissue of the vulva, which leads to the itching and the appearance and the fissures or small paper cuts that can occur. But the other component of this condition, and everyone has a different level of how this manifests, but the other component of this condition is that skin sticks together that normally doesn't. And that's the scarring component. And then there's also a resorption component, meaning like a shrinkage of the labia minora that plays a role. And so with scarring, we tend to see the scarring occur in the midline. So we tend to see the sides of the clitoral hood or prepuce stick together, and it almost zips up or zips down over the glans clitoris, which is the part of the clitoris that we can see. And this can zip down partially, making it hard to really pop the clitoris out like the head of a turtle, or it can zip up completely and you can't see the clitoris at all. And it's almost like stimulation is going through a blanket or a covering, and it can decrease orgasm. It can make it harder to have an orgasm. It takes longer, or it can take it away altogether because you're basically trying to stimulate through a thick layer of scar tissue. The other place that we see scarring that affects sexual function is at the top and the bottom of the vaginal opening. So at the introitus or the vaginal opening, you can have stickiness and scarring at 12 o'clock and at 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock tends to be the biggest issue. So at 6 o'clock, there can be a scar band or a tissue band that forms. And every time someone tries to have intercourse, we know the scar tissue is fragile, right? It breaks easily. It doesn't have a good blood supply. It's not healthy tissue. And so when you have intercourse, it tears open or rips open. And that can cause a little bit of spotting. It can cause bleeding, burning, discomfort. And it's distressing, honestly. And then when it heals back together, which it has a propensity to do, it creates more scar tissue. So it's breakage, scar tissue. And it becomes this, this cycle, which is very distressing. And it's one of the main presenting complaints that I see. It's one of the main things that brings people into the office if they're of reproductive age, so 20s, 30s, 40s, whether they've been diagnosed with lichen sclerosis yet or not. It's one of the big things that people say, okay, this is what is going to finally bring me in because it's really affecting my sex life and it's affecting my ability to have pleasure. And so there are things that we can do about all of these things. But I should say that just treating with a topical steroid or just treating the lichen sclerosis to put you in remission does not automatically correct the scar tissue. The scar tissue can, you know, it's usually what's left, right? Even after we treat. And so sometimes we need to do things like massaging the scar tissue with dilator therapy, perineal massage, or even a very, very minor procedure that's done under anesthesia to remove that scar tissue and open up that area to create functionality again. Mm-hmm. Same with the clitoris. We can treat the lichen sclerosis, but it doesn't always uncover the clitoris. Sometimes it does, but I usually set expectations for patients that it doesn't always. And so sometimes we need to do a very minor procedure to unzip the clitoris as well.
How do you make it not zip back up? So like, you know, as a surgeon, I can understand, you know, you can open it up under anesthesia, but then how does it not just go vunk back down again? You put them on a strict like post-procedure, like they have to retract and they've got to put estrogen cream. Do you have a protocol, a post-zip protocol?
So this is the biggest risk with this type of procedure. There's a 30% chance of recurrence with this. And that actually, that number is actually pretty low because that is with this full regimen that we do. I mean, this tissue wants to stick back together. However, I've had great success with my post-operative regimen. I think that's the key. Anyone can unzip this. Anyone can do these fairly minor procedures, but where the expertise comes in is knowing how the body works and knowing how this condition works to prevent it from sticking back together. And so what I do is I use a combination of local hormones, so estradiol and testosterone, clobetasol or ultrapotent topical steroid in a very specific regimen on the healing edges. And what that does is it delays healing, but it heals open. And then of course, dilator therapy, retraction of the area, and really pushing back that area to keep that all of those areas open. So I have a very specific postoperative regimen that my patients follow. And through that, we've had really great success, which we have published.
That's amazing. So I had a woman write in, and of course we don't have any pictures or an exam, but I just want to read her story and just get your thoughts on kind of where you would start with this without being able to examine her. But so this woman wrote in and she says, I don't know if I have lichen sclerosis, lichen planus, or vulvovaginal atrophy. It's worse after my primary care took me off systemic hormones at age 60 because they told her age 60 was when you needed to stop your systemic hormones. I get really sore, like somebody's hitting me in the vagina area. I have burning. I have no itching. And I have no white patches, but certainly a loss of architecture.
Okay. So again, caveat, I have not examined this patient. This is all theoretical. I would say given her postmenopausal status, she most certainly has GSM. And of course, you know, these things can obviously they occur together. So GSM definitely. And then from the description of it, it sounds like lichen planus. Of course, we would want an exam and potentially a biopsy to confirm that. But the difference is with, so lichen sclerosis tends to affect the skin of the vulva. And so it affects the outside area, whereas lichen planus affects the mucosa. So where we often see lichen planus is actually in the mouth. So a lot of people will be diagnosed by their dentist. They have it on the inside of their cheek. They have a white lacy appearance that's very characteristic of lichen planus, and they may develop oral ulcers, recurrent ulcers in their mouth. And so And so it's not uncommon when I see a patient who comes in with this presentation, I ask them, oh, has your dentist ever mentioned anything? Or do you get ulcers a lot? And she's like, oh yeah, he said I had this weird thing called lichen planus. It's like, okay, well, guess what? So because we see it on mucous membranes, we tend to see it in the genital area on the vestibule, which is kind of like that transition zone. But it's technically a part of the vulva, but it's a transition zone between the squamous epithelium of the vulva and the mucosa of the vagina. And so we see it on the vestibule, and then we see it intravaginally as well. And the reason why it's so important is because lichen planus, the scarring that it can create can occur inside the vagina, and it can actually create adhesions or scar tissue formation inside the vagina, which can decrease the length of the vagina or make it difficult with insertion. We also see vulvar changes in architecture, scarring related changes with lichen planus on the outside. So I have seen covering of the clitoris called clitoral phimosis. We definitely see narrowing of the vaginal opening that goes with lichen planus. But with the scarring over the clitoris, it's kind of hard to say, like, is that lichen sclerosis and lichen planus together with GSM? We don't 100% know, or is that just a manifestation of the lichen planus? These conditions are sisters, right? They have a lot of things in common. They just tend to affect slightly different types of tissue, but we do see an overlap. The good thing is the treatment is very similar. It's just a matter of where it is applied.
So what do you put in the vagina for treatment of lichen planus?
Yes. So I don't use an ultra potent steroid for that. I use a lower potency steroid. So I use hydrocortisone, which you can use in a suppository form, or I have it compounded with estradiol. So that's what I use for inside the vagina. And then I have patients apply it with a dilator to prevent adhesion formation or scar tissue formation. So it addresses both issues at one time.
Brilliant. Why is it important for people, once they've been diagnosed and treated, why is it important to stay on maintenance therapy?
Yes.
Because I'm sure people are like, can't this be done? Can't this go away?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple of reasons. Number one, if we believe these to be autoimmune conditions, which we know lichen planus is an autoimmune condition, it's T-cell mediated. So we know more about the pathophysiology or the cause of lichen planus than we do about lichen sclerosis. But we believe they're both autoimmune conditions. And so if that's the case, then sure, symptoms can wax and wane as far as your local immune response and the level of inflammation that your own body and skin are producing. But this is not something that's ever going to really go away completely, just like thyroid disease. You know, you may need less medication as far as thyroid replacement, or, you know, you may be able to, you know, make modifications based on diet and exposure and lifestyle and behavioral interventions, but you always have a predisposition, or you always have it kind of in the background. And it's the same with lichen sclerosis and lichen planus. And so the maintenance would be for a couple reasons. Number one, we want to prevent flares. We want to prevent worsening of symptoms in the future. Number two, we would want to prevent scarring, the progression of further scarring if scarring is present. And then three, we would want to prevent the progression to a vulvar precancer or a vulvar cancer. Lichen planus also has an association with vulvar precancer and cancer as well.
Very good information. So when I was researching, you know, all these conditions for the podcast today, I came across a doctor who offers a treatment. They claim a one and done treatment for lichen sclerosis, and it's a laser therapy. And it's kind of branded. It's got a brand name to it. Can you tell me what the experts think about, you know, the laser therapies? Or because certainly that would seem very enticing to some women, of like, oh, you're telling me I can just come to your town and then I'm done with this thing. What are the experts saying about, you know, is that on the horizon, or is that not as great as advertised? Any opinions on that?
So yes, so we need more research on laser therapy. The issue with laser therapy is there's many components to laser therapy, and We know a little bit about how it works for things like GSM, but we don't know if it completely decreases the large amounts of inflammation that occur in lichen sclerosis. What we do have is that randomized control trial that was done by Dr. Goldstein and myself and a number of our colleagues that actually looked at biopsy results before and after laser CO2 laser therapy. And this was randomized. So it's the best type of study that we have. And we found that laser therapy did not decrease inflammation based on histology. And this was a blinded histopathologist that was looking at these slides. Now, there was a study that was also run in the Green Journal at the same time that was looking at laser therapy and looking at basically symptoms of patients and provider evaluation. And so it seems like with the studies that have been done so far with this, and we need more, but with the studies that have been done so far, it seems like laser therapy does improve symptoms and it does improve the look of the tissue, but we're not confident that it actually improves the inflammation under the skin. In fact, the randomized control trial that was done shows that it does not, based on just one trial. Of course, more are needed. Now, my personal theory about this, and I have had a discussion, there was a Zoom webinar that went over these articles with one of the main societies on this. And so I was present and we had a full discussion. And this was with dermatologists and gynecologists and really the experts in the field about this. The idea here is perhaps laser therapy, because we know that with laser, it basically pokes teeny little holes in the tissue and it improves collagen, it stimulates collagen production and so forth. Perhaps it increases permeability of the tissue. And maybe if we put a topical steroid on, then the steroid would be more effective because it would be able to get down to that lower level of inflammation. Now, again, this is all conjecture. These are all theories. This is not, there's not really studies that have really reliably looked at this, but this is kind of where things are going. But then my argument to this discussion was, well, that's what I do with how I recommend how patients apply this. I have them soak prior to application because it softens the thickened skin, which increases permeability, which is why I believe Dr. Goldstein and I get better results using the topical steroid than someone who just puts topical steroid on the top of the skin without going through all the skin prep that is necessary. And then my argument to that is, well, why spend thousands and thousands of dollars on laser therapy to increase the effectiveness of a topical medication when you could soak prior to applying it? Now, I don't know. There hasn't been like a head-to-head study looking at one versus the other to see, you know, perhaps laser therapy would make it so much more effective that cost would be warranted. But we don't have that information at this time, and we don't even know if it would be helpful. So this is where the field hopefully is going as we kind of figure this out, you know. And then the other component of this is to really nail down what exactly is causing this inflammation in the first place. Like, what genes are at play? What proteins are at play? You know, what does the body identify to create this inflammation? So we can really even get more targeted therapies that are not steroidal in nature. But I would be cautious about any treatment that says that it's going to cure this. That doesn't make sense in my mind as to how this condition works, that you could do something that would altogether cure it completely without addressing whatever proteins that we haven't discovered yet. So that's my thought on that.
That makes sense. It makes, I like, you know, to simplify it for me, it's like the laser probably has a role in helping with the scar tissue and the inflexibility that people get. But actually treating a systemic inflammatory condition, we can't give the laser all that power.
Well, we have to be careful because this isn't systemic inflammatory, right? It's local inflammatory. And that's important to differentiate also, because autoimmune conditions are usually associated with other autoimmune conditions, but the autoimmune conditions that lichen sclerosis is associated with are the more like what we call benign conditions. So alopecia accreta, which is a special type of hair loss, vitiligo, which is whitening of the skin without thickening, thyroid conditions like Graves and Hashimoto's, but it's not associated with things like lupus, right? Which are more serious systemic inflammatory conditions. So it's really what we're talking about is local inflammation. Now, there was a study that I recently did, again, in patients of reproductive age, where I asked about gluten sensitivity. So there wasn't a way that I could prove that they had celiac disease, because that actually is like a whole battery of tests necessary to show that. But as far as like gluten sensitivity, which is kind of like I eat gluten and I don't feel well, we did find a statistical significant association between people who have lichen sclerosis and gluten sensitivity. So there may be some sort of component with that, and that may be autoimmune as well. And it does explain why people feel that their lichen sclerosis symptoms may improve when they follow a gluten sensitive diet or gluten free diet as well. But again, we don't have any research on this.
Right. But something people could try. I mean, it wouldn't hurt you to just see if you know, something in your diet helps your symptoms.
And it often does. It really often does. There's a big link, I believe, between lichen sclerosis and diet.
Amazing. So to wrap it up, I have a lot of people and their partners listen to this podcast. And I think, you know, it's hard for men because they don't get any education in, you know, female genitals any more than women do. It's hard for them to kind of understand what's going on. They just know their partner like doesn't want to have sex with them as much because it hurts. What advice or what words would you like to say to the partners in how can they can best support somebody who's going through a condition like this?
Exactly. So I think that the most important thing is to learn a little bit about it. And it's a hard condition to talk about. And I have a lot of patients that, you know, just started dating somebody and it's like, how do they bring that up? Or they're out in the dating world and they're like, and I think that the thing to realize is when you know that you have this condition and you're looking all the time, it's much larger for you as far as the skin changes than it is for any partner. They're usually, a lot of partners don't even realize that there's something different. And so I think just reassuring as a partner, you can reassure the person that they're beautiful no matter what, and you enjoy being with them. And as far as working out pain conditions, there are ways, there are treatments, there are ways to work around it. And just being patient, knowing that it's not in someone's head, that these are actual conditions. There are, there's reasons behind it. There's reasons why scarring occurs. There's reasons why changes occur to the area. And, you know, I'm hoping that I've had a lot of patients and a lot of people on social media tell me, like, I'm so thankful for your page because I can show my partner what's going on. Or, you know, I really appreciated the YouTube video that you posted because I shared it with my partner and it made so much more sense why I'm having these symptoms. And that, you know, there's misconceptions. This is not a sexually transmitted infection. It's not contagious. You know, it's important to reiterate these things. These are things that, you know, your doctor may not have the time or expertise to go over with you. It's the nitty gritty things of like, okay, how do I remove hair in this area? Or what diet is best for me? Or what kind of underwear do I wear? Or how do I talk to my partner? And some of these things honestly come from just experience of seeing patients over and over and being in this community and listening to my patients, listening to people who follow me on social media, you know, conversations with people in the lichen sclerosis support network, following, you know, what the support groups advocate and say. And I think all of this is really, really valuable.
Beautiful. This is such a powerful episode. And I think it's going to be such an amazing resource just in the years to come to have this episode for people to come back on. Follow Dr. Kraft. She's amazing. She does very, very good Instagram reels, by the way. And I get to hang out with her at Ishwish in 2022 in a couple of months. I'm excited. And you need to give me all your real skills too, because your Instagram is awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us so much today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.